Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 214, and we're going to talk about the shakedown. No, the man isn't coming for you. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the shakedown trip, where you see if everything worked. We're also going to talk about wireless backup cameras and how there's an interesting solution for them. Some cheap tools from Menards that are actually really good. And what happens when you take a magician to a casino? I will have a story about that as well. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks very much for joining me here today. I am currently in Aurora, Colorado. I was in Aurora, Nebraska last night. Tonight I'm in Aurora, Colorado. I cannot get away from auroras. I have visited every aurora in the United States and in Canada at least once, many of them several times, and I really do need to get off my butt and write that book about that. But anyway, thank you so much for joining me. I'm actually in a hotel because I am traveling with my Scamp. Now, my Scamp is a 1993 13-foot Scamp camper. It is a fiberglass, kind of an egg on wheels. They're fairly iconic. They have a huge following. They're like the fiberglass Airstreams. You know, people have a cult following of these things, and therefore they pay way too much for them. But I didn't. I got mine at a good price, and I just recently fixed it all up. And this is my first big trip in it. And yeah, everything is going wrong. I mean, not everything, but enough things are going wrong that I thought I would maybe talk about the topic of the shakedown cruise, which, you know, comes from the shipping industry. Ships being very complex things that have to deal with all kinds of different physics, like buoyancy and wind and waves. And, you know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong with ships. Just ask the crew of the Vasa that they would take the ship out minimally fitted, you know, just like it was seaworthy, but that was it, and then mess around with it and see what would happen. They still do this with modern cruise ships. Before a cruise ship is put into service, it's taken on a shakedown voyage where they go fast, they go slow, they take turns, they try to go into weather, all that kind of stuff to make sure they did everything right. And you know what? They never do everything right. I mean, there are always problems discovered on a shakedown cruise. And I think that's true of just about everything. Now, you're going to have fewer of these problems if you're dealing with a professional because they've already done this and know what to avoid. But if you're building out your own rig, or you are, as I am, refitting an older rig, your first trip out, you're probably going to run into a lot of problems. And I did. So I thought I would tell you that story and then talk about what to do about it. Well, I'll tell you about what to do about it now. You can't. You can't do anything about it. You have to do it. It's a trial and error kind of thing. You can take all kinds of precautions against things going wrong, but until you're out there on the road, you don't really know. So you learn as much as you can, you put in as much diligence as you can, and then you take your best shot, get out on the road, and then lick your wounds, which is what I'm doing right now. Now, this isn't my first rodeo. All right, there's my one cliche I'm allowed to use today. I obviously have done shakedowns before. I did a shakedown in my NV200, and I've talked an awful lot about how your first night in your van will be terrible. And my first night in my NV200 was absolutely horrible. I froze to death. There were literally icicles hanging from the ceiling. It was terrible. But I learned so much from it. My ambulance has been such a gradual build that I haven't actually, I mean, I've been kind of putting the wings on as I'm flying the plane. Oh, damn, another cliche. But anyway, it's not really a good example because there hasn't been a shakedown. The Scamp, however, there has been. I spent probably the last four weekends, doing everything I could to fix everything in the Scamp, and I just drove it 1,000 miles. And, well, I'll give you a list of everything that's gone wrong. First off, remember that holding tank that I built and created and installed, I talked about last week? Yeah, that fell off. I don't know when it fell off. I think it fell off almost immediately. But I drove the Scamp from Tikibago Land to Chicago. And when I got to Chicago, yeah, nothing there. The entire tank is gone. There's just these straps hanging down. I'm like, oh, that was a lot of effort wasted. What did I learn from that? Well, I learned that I shouldn't have done that. That was kind of dumb. And I also learned that what I did that was really wrong in this, and I should have known better, was that I use self-tapping screws. So let's do a sidebar here on self-tapping screws. Self-tapping screws are screws that have a little drill bit at the end, and they're very good for single use sheet metal, meaning you are going to screw something into the sheet metal and then it'll never get touched again. That's it. You're never going to unscrew this screw. And I used it for wood. This is dumb. Don't do this. I should have known better. I don't know why I wasn't thinking at the time I did this. I think it was a case of what screws do I have handy right now? And that is a big trap that you have to avoid when you're building. It happens to me all the time. I'm tired. I just want to get this thing done. Ugh. I really need a different kind of screws. Oh, but I have this big box of screws here. I'll make them work. This was an example of why you shouldn't do that. So self-tapping screws, like I said, they drill a hole as you put the screw in. Well, that hole is of a certain size. And in wood, it's too big. The way wood screws work is they have to bite into the wood. And you want a little tiny hole for a much bigger screw. And a self-tapper makes it too big of a hole. So there's no grip on the screws. And even though my holding tank was empty, it wasn't anywhere near its maximum weight, it got ripped off. Now, I don't know if I hit something, it did hang fairly low, or if it just fell off because the screws were insufficient. I don't know. I may never know. But I do have a sneaking suspicion that when I next go back down to Tiki Bagelland, it's going to be sitting in the road. Because I think that's where I may have bottomed out and ripped it off. So I'm working on a new kludge for that, and I'll tell you about that if it works. It may not. But in the meantime, the way the scamp is designed, there is a wastewater outlet on the side of the scamp that you can attach a hose to, and then that water can go into a bucket. And that's how I'm going to handle my gray water for this trip. Another thing that went wrong, and this was fairly unpredictable, but it's weird. The scamp attracts ladybugs. Due to its design, for whatever reason, in the winter, ladybugs love it in there, and thousands of ladybugs crawl in there and winter over. Now, this last winter was particularly cold, and they all froze and died. So I opened it up in the spring, and I had lots of ladybugs everywhere. Not the worst thing in the world. They're fairly easy to vacuum up. And I did. I spent a good hour vacuuming every little crevice I could find in the scamp and thought, good to go. I drive down the road a few hundred miles, pull over, go into the scamp, and the floor is covered with ladybugs, dead ladybugs. Apparently, they were in places that I couldn't reach with a vacuum, or I didn't think to vacuum, like underneath things that I couldn't see regularly. And yeah, they all fell down now. So I had to vacuum them up. And that will come up later in the product review part. Then another thing that happened that is completely unexpected to me was the stove came loose. Now, my scamp has a two-burner stove, very classic Wedgwood two-burner camping stove. Very, very common thing in RVs. And it came loose. Now, I had just screwed it in. I'm sure it was tight. And this thing is a 93. So, you know, this top has seen some use. And I didn't take it off-road or anything. It wasn't a particularly rough road. So what caused it to come loose? I don't really know. But it did. And maybe, for all I know, it always came loose. And the previous owner had to deal with this constantly. I don't know. But I was like, wow. That made me realize that physics is a very difficult thing to deal with intuitively. The forces that were happening in the back of that scamp were enough to do things like knock a placemat off the table. Okay, that's not so huge. But to knock a piece of wood out from a grooved slot and lift up the stove. And actually, the thing that surprised me the most is I had a rubber pot holder hanging off of a hook, and it was very tight on the hook, and that fell off too. Anyway, the point of this is that it's rough back there, and this is more of a trailer thing than a van thing. It is definitely true of vans. Things are going to get shaken more than you might imagine, but in the back of a trailer, things get shaken crazy. I mean, it's like the trailer gets picked up and shaken, and well, that is somewhat what it's like because of the way the suspension is on the trailer, because it's hooked to the front. It has that one firm point. The trailer literally is bouncing around back there, and you have to be super, super careful with how you secure things. And I thought I was. This, again, is not my first rodeo. I did it again. But Yeah. So anyway, what does this all mean? Is my trip ruined? Is everything? No. I mean, this is part of it. I knew this was going to happen to some extent. I'm disappointed about the holding tank. I really wish that had stayed on there, but I have nothing to blame but myself. I totally did that wrong. It's completely my fault. So that's that. The stove is a surprise. That's not something I would have expected. I will fix that. Not the end of the world. Ladybugs, just vacuum them up. And as far as things falling off hooks on the walls, that is not a big deal. But it has informed me that I do have a little bit of artwork I'm going to put on the walls. I'm going to put up the artwork a lot differently than I had originally planned. It is now going to be screwed into the walls, not with self-tapping screws. And I want it to stay put. Anyway, when you are ready to do a shakedown of your camper, and maybe you should do this several times during the process, make sure you go down some rough roads, make sure you go down highway speeds, do something approaching an emergency stop, because that's probably the most dangerous part of the thing, is slamming on the brakes, stuff flying forward and hitting you in the head. Very, very bad. So do all these things, but psychologically know that stuff's going to go wrong on your first trip. It's just how it is. It may be minor stuff. It may be major stuff. I mean, heck, anyone who lives full time in a van knows that there's always something wrong with the van. You're hoping for like 98% everything working. A lot of times it's only 90%. It's never, ever, ever going to be 100. That's true for RV owners or anything. But it's okay. This is the price we pay to enable ourselves to go out there and live this lifestyle. And that is far, far, far more valuable than just giving up and saying you want to live in a house or a condo, which, guess what, folks? They're never at 100% either. I do have a couple of corrections I wanted to make. And the first correction is that a few episodes back, I mentioned going to Peru, where I was bartering with people, even though I couldn't speak their language. That is not true, technically, being a little pedantic here. But my friend Mike pointed this out, and he's right, and it deserves a correction. Bartering is trading goods for services or trading goods for goods or something like that. It has nothing to do with haggling over the price, which is what I was actually doing. I was haggling over the price, even though I couldn't speak Spanish, and I was not bartering. I was giving cash for goods and services, negotiating a price. That is haggling. So thank you, Mike, for the correction. Corrections are always appreciated, no matter how small, and I want to own up to that one. I'm sorry it's taken me so long to actually get it on the air. The other one is, in my thing about tires, I said something that has been bothering me, and no one's actually commented on this, but I thought I would bring it up. The tire pressure that is written on the side of your tires, that is the maximum cold PSI. That means you're supposed to take that pressure when the tire's cold. You haven't been driving it. Therefore, let's say it's set for 45, it says 45 on the sidewall, you pump 45 pounds per square inch of air in there. If you drive for a while, it's going to be more than 45, but that's built in. The manufacturers understand that. That's why they specify cold. It's a stable place where no matter what, it should always be at 45. So I think I misstated that a bit, and it's fine. The advice still stands, though. That's not the number you care about. The number you care about is in the owner's manual or on the sidewall of the door. And if you delve into this, you're going to find out it's hugely controversial. People have all kinds of opinions on tire pressure. But the other stuff I talked about there generally will hold true. Higher tire pressures mean better gas mileage, stiffer ride. Lower tire pressure means better ride, worse gas mileage, and possibly more tire wear. Anyway, sorry for not being clear on that earlier, but I am glad to have had the chance to correct it. And now I must thank Kent. Thank you, Kent. Thank you for your support. I appreciate it. And thanks to everyone who donate every month at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. You folks make it possible for me to do the podcast without including advertising. Makes me happy, makes you happy. It's a win-win. And of course, any of you folks who have bought me a gallon of diesel at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo are welcome to receive a free Hook Walk a Bang sticker. All you have to do is send me your address and live in the U.S. or Canada, and I will get that right out to you. So send that to jeff@builttogo.com. And yeah, you know how many T's there are. Van life news. Just a very quick bit of news. Gas prices, fuel prices are all over the dang place. things have changed. This summer is different. I have driven now from Illinois to Colorado, so across the Midwest, across the whole center of the United States. Gas prices are lower than I have been seeing. I did pay less than $3 a gallon in Iowa for gasoline, but I've been watching the prices of diesel and gasoline, and sometimes diesel's cheaper than gasoline, and sometimes it's not, and sometimes they're the same price. This is the first time in many years that this has been the case. So this is good news for all of us, honestly. Gas prices are pretty good right now, and given that this is the start of the summer, that's a little bit unexpected. So I went and filled up my Sprinter for $3.28 a gallon, which is the cheapest I think I have ever paid for diesel since I've owned it. And that was nice. I liked that. Tech Talk. So my Airstream came with a wireless backup camera. This is very common in the RV world, where if you have a trailer or vehicle didn't come with a backup camera, a rear view camera, as it were, you buy a wireless one. And so the Airstream came with one. And it consists of two parts. There's a screen that goes up front, and then there is a camera that mounts in the back, and that's it. There's no wires, which isn't true. There is one wire or two wires, and that is you need to give power to this rear view camera. So how do you do that? Well, the clever solution that most people seem to do is that they wire the camera that's in the back of your trailer or your van or wherever you mount it, to the parking lights. And the idea is that if you turn on your parking lights, it powers this camera, and then that's it. That's all you have to do. You don't have to install a new circuit or anything like that. They're fairly low draw. You're not going to have to worry about blowing fuses or anything like that. And you can turn it on and off. And the argument is that if you're towing a trailer, again, this is mostly a trailer thing, you're going to want to tow with your lights on anyway. So that's how it works. That's how it's wired into the Airstream at the factory. And as it happened, I found an extra camera in the Airstream. There were two cameras for some reason. I don't understand why. Something went wrong at some point, and the previous owners bought a replacement. I don't know what happened, but I don't care. I got a free camera out of it, and I put it on the Scamp. And I did exactly that. I wired it into the taillights, and it works fine. And so now I can see behind the Scamp. I have the front screen plugged into the cigarette lighter outlet. It's mounted to the floor with Velcro, and I can glance down and see behind the Scamp. Now, if you want to install one of these in your van, you have an option, which is interesting. That mounting for the camera can move. So it doesn't have to be permanent. On my Scamp, instead of mounting that extra camera permanently, I actually wrapped it around the spare tire with a tight strap. And that works great. And then, as long as I can keep it powered, it becomes a security camera. Everything moves, so I can move the screen inside the Scamp and then put that camera wherever I want. Again, as long as it's powered, I could wire it to a battery, I could wire it to something else, I could wire it to the truck and then have it sit on the truck and have it watch the trailer, whatever. It becomes a little bit like a security camera. And again, these are fairly low draw devices. So I mention this just to give you an idea that if you bought one of these rear view, wireless rear view cameras, that if you don't mount the camera permanently or you put it in some kind of removable mount, you have an option to play with it. And that's actually pretty valuable. One way I can think it's valuable, and I haven't actually done this yet, but I could take it off, put it on the front of the trailer and point it at the hitch, and I could use it to help guide me into backing up the truck onto the hitch, because I don't have one of those fancy trucks that will auto hitch up, Hal. But yeah. Some of you do. This is a new thing. I don't know if you've heard of this, but there are trucks now, mostly by Ford, I think, that you can actually set into a mode where they'll back up to a trailer all by themselves. You don't have to do anything. Anyway, I know running wires for backup cameras can be a pain. A lot of people use the license plate camera. I've had to do it in a lot of vehicles. It is a long way to run a wire, and sometimes the wire's not long enough. So consider the wireless cameras as another option. I will say one thing, though. In the example of the one that I have, which is from 2018, so it's a few years old now, the quality isn't as good as the wired cameras. And you can see that there's something there, but like it's difficult to make out what make of car is behind the vehicle, for example. I can see there's a car. That's the important part. But I couldn't tell you if it was a Dodge or a Toyota or whatever. product review. So you remember I said that my scamp was filled with ladybugs. I have a broom in the scamp. The floor of the scamp, of my scamp, has a fairly recent carpet. It's like a commercial-grade carpet, very low pile. And there's a broom in there, and you can just sweep it out. And that works fairly well. But there are so many ladybugs, and they have those little grabby feet that it was kind of a pain trying to sweep them out. So I just happened to be in Menards getting other stuff, and I saw they had these little battery-powered vacuum cleaners. Now, I've talked about 12-volt vacuum cleaners before. I have that one I really like that I have bought several of, but I didn't bring it with me for some reason, so I didn't have that. And I thought, well, I guess I could have a cordless one. That wouldn't be a terrible idea. And this one also doubled as a blower. So I thought, okay, but you know, I don't want to spend a lot of money on this. I'm trying to do the scamp thing fairly on the cheap. But then I looked, it was $15. Rechargeable, lithium. Like, that sounds too good to be true. And it's this one thing that reverses. It can be a blower or a vacuum. And I was like, all right, I'll try it out. What the heck? And so I got it and I tried it out. And yeah, it's a little tiny battery. It's not going to last very long. In fact, it says in the owner's manual, 12-minute runtime. And then it comes with a little wall wart to recharge it. It's not very sophisticated. But holy cow, this thing worked great. I used it to blow out my refrigerator. That was another problem I had with the scamp. The refrigerator is so old that when I was running it on propane, soot fell out of the chimney onto the burner and put the fire out and all my food got warm. Separate thing. But I needed to blow that out, so I was able to use it as the blower for that. And then I vacuumed up all those ladybugs in like 30 seconds. Okay, 12-minute runtime sounds terrible, but when you're vacuuming a small vehicle like a van or a scamp, that's plenty. And it's only $15. So I thought, well, wonder what other tools they have in this line. It turns out they have a lot of tools in this same line, which is called North Tech, which has probably nothing to do with the North and has questionable technology. But they have drills and chainsaws and flashlights and fans. I mean, there's this whole line of tools. Now, there's an old truism that a cheap tool is a false economy. And yet somehow Harbor Freight exists, right? So, you know, we're in this world where we all know that we should be spending the money on the Snap-on and the Milwaukees and all that. We know in the real world that we can get by with the cheaper stuff in many cases. This stuff is so cheap that if it works for a year, I think it's worth it. And in fact, I think I'm going to go back and buy just about the entire line of these North Tech tools. Every single tool for $15, every tool comes with a battery and a charger. And then, so if you buy several of these tools, you end up with a bunch of the batteries. So that 12-minute runtime of the vacuum cleaner suddenly becomes 24 or 36. I did go back and buy the drill because it's always useful to have another drill. Now, I will say that if you are starting to build out a van, you are going to want to buy at least one decent quality drill. I've been using rigid drills from Home Depot for years, the 12-volt ones, which are hard to find now. I like them because they're very lightweight and you can get them into places without having that big battery bank. That is not a high quality tool, but it's a decent quality tool. That was fine. But you don't want to use a super low quality drill in your van because that drill is going to get a whole lot of use. So I don't think this should be your primary drill. But as a secondary drill, I mean, I imagine this scenario where you have your good drill, maybe it's an 18-volt Milwaukee or DeWalt or something like that, and then you have this other North Tech $15 drill, and you drill your holes with the fancy one, and then you just put the screws in with the North Tech. And I thought, all right, this North Tech, I mean, it's so cheap. It's not going to have a clutch. It's not going to have it. No, this thing has everything. It's got the clutch. It's got a flashlight. It is a cheap version of the expensive tools. And it's also pretty lightweight. So basically, folks, I'm saying these cheap Menard tools, I mean, they're cheaper than Harbor Freight. And they're better quality insofar as I can tell during my short usage. And I think you should check it out. Their one caveat is that you can't mail order these. You have to go to a Menards. And if you've not heard of Menards, you are probably not in the middle of the United States. The Menards is a big Midwest box store. A little bit different. They're different than Home Depot or Lowe's. They sell food and furniture. And it's a store. It's not a warehouse. They actually have like nice lighting and it's air conditioned. So I love Menards, honestly. Plus, there's an 11% rebate they do every month. If you mail in your receipts, they'll send you a gift card for 11% off everything, which is a pain, but still. Anyway, check it out. If you happen to be near Menards, go look at these tools. Consider them spares, but it's always a good idea to travel with a drill, and this $15 drill might be all you need. Tales from the Road. So, as I've talked about many times, and I will never stop talking about, I used to work for James the Amazing Randy, a magician of some note, and one of my great pleasures was to be able to travel with him, and we did a few travel with Randy cruises. I mean, some of them were pretty big deals. We went to the Galapagos. Our first one was in the Bermuda Triangle. We went to Alaska, and we did a whole bunch of things, and Randy is the kind of guy who never, ever went on vacation. That just was not his thing. Vacations were not a thing. Travel was. If he traveled to do his work, he would do that. But the idea of going on vacation just wasn't his thing. So he did these as part of work. But he loved it. He loved every minute of it, because every night he would gather in a lounge somewhere and all the guests would just hold court with him, and he would regale us with tales and magic tricks. It was a really wonderful time, and I'm glad to have had that in my life. But Randy, not only was he a magician, he was also an escape artist, and he was a studious escape artist. And he got to the point where he could be considered a master locksmith. He knew how locks worked. He knew how safes worked. He knew how jail cells worked. His tagline at one point was, "The man no jail could hold." And he has a great many stories of breaking out of jail. And I've told this story many, many times, but when I first met him and I first started working for his foundation, the James Randi Educational Foundation, I sat right outside his office, and the story was he had lost the keys to his office years ago, so he used a lockpick to get into his office every single morning. And while I don't know if he actually lost the keys, he did actually use a lockpick to get into his office, which was charming to me. At any rate, couple of stories about this. We went to Yahoo headquarters in LA a way long time ago, 2006 or 7, and they were talking about doing a TV show with us. It didn't work out, and Yahoo TV didn't work out either, as you may not recall because you've never heard of it, but they were trying to do some stuff. It's all fine, but as we were leaving the Yahoo office building, Randy noticed that they had a bunch of laptops in the foyer, the lobby area, for people to use, and they were all locked with these Kensington locks. If you've not seen Kensington locks, they're like a thin wire that locks into your computer. These were a little different. They weren't the normal Kensington lock where you use the round key to open them. These had combination locks on them. And Randy looked and said, And I witnessed this. I watched this. He went to every single one, and in 3 seconds had each of those locks unlocked. Now, this guy was in his 80s at this point. YouTube was just starting to be a thing. I don't know where he got the knowledge for how to do this so quickly. Now, these days, you can go on YouTube and say, how to unlock without key, blah, 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 and you'll find a way to do it. He didn't have that resource. All he had was his experience and his innate knowledge of how locks worked. But he did it. He unlocked all the laptops, which I thought was a kind of a mean thing to do. But he did. And then we left. And I learned that this was how Randy was. He was always trying to figure things out. And if he could make a show of his knowledge of figuring things out, he would do that. And that brings us back to the cruises. So cruise ships have casinos, most of them, and one of the machines they have in the casinos is the coin drop, where you put a quarter in the top and there are these trays that move and the quarter falls onto the trays and hits all these other quarters, and hopefully, and if you look at the machine, it seems inevitable that this will happen, the quarter will push the quarters into the tray and you can collect the quarters and yay, your one quarter gave you $1.25 because all those quarters fell down. I don't think Randy had ever seen one of these machines before. He's not the kind of guy that had spent a lot of time in casinos, other than in the stages in Vegas. You know, he would be in Vegas all the time, but he would be on the stage. He would not be in the casino. Anyway, he sat down at this machine, and he had a group of people following him, and he held out his hand. Now, this was a completely silent affair. There was no voice in this story. Randy was completely silent. He holds out his hand, and the people with him, being of above average intelligence, realized that he was asking for some money to put in the machine. And the people were like, ooh, Randy's going to do something with his machine. So quarters just appear out of pockets. And this is back in the days when people actually had change. And Randy's hand is filled with quarters. And he starts putting them in one by one. Ka-chink. 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 And there's different slots you can put the coins in. He's trying different slots. He's putting a little spin on the coins. You can see him working the machine, figuring out its weakness. But he's out of quarters then. He only got a couple back. He sticks out his hand again. Whoosh! Quarters come back into his hand. This goes on for half an hour. Randy wins very, very little out of the machine. He probably puts $20 worth of quarters into the machine and gets back maybe $1.50. But the crowd is still there, and every time he pulls out his hand, it fills with quarters. And then he just got up, smiled, and wandered off. And the charming part about this for me is that the trick is he did beat the machine, because the machine isn't what needs to be beaten. It's the people. And every time he put out his hand, quarters appeared and magically filled his hand. That was the trick. That was the joke. Because the truth is, those machines are rigged, because heck, it's a casino. All the machines are rigged. And if you haven't paid a lot of attention to how the machines work, coins disappear through the sides. Once the coin falls down and hits another coin, it puts pressure on the other coins, but that pressure pushes them to the side where they fall into hidden slots, and you don't even see them fall. So yeah, that coin falling is going to push coins off, but not where you can get them unless you're very, very lucky. I mean, remember, folks, they put these things on cruise ships. Cruise ships move, so they're stable enough for that. I don't know that the people with Randy realized that they were part of the trick. In fact, really, they were being the ones tricked. But for me, just watching on the edge, I thought it was a brilliant, really interesting piece of how to beat a casino. You want to beat a casino? Buy stock in the casino. That's how you beat a casino. A place to visit. So one of the reasons I'm in Aurora, Colorado now is not simply because it's on the way to where I'm going, but because I wanted to meet one of my favorite friends, Susie, at Meow Wolf. Now, I have been to Meow Wolf in Santa Fe when it first opened, and I absolutely loved it. And I have to say, Meow Wolf Denver is like taken to the next level. If you are not familiar with Meow Wolf, it is a museum, a theme park, I guess, a live experience. It's a really hard thing to explain, but it's basically several floors of an art installation that you walk into and engage with. Now, the one in Denver is called Convergence, and it is a convergence of three, I'm telling you as they describe it to me, three different planets that have come together, and you can walk between the worlds. And you can interact with the worlds with a little card that I think costs $3 or something like that. And then you can scan it in places and make things happen. And then there are mysteries to solve. And sometimes when you scan the card, like a robot will start talking to you and ask you to complete a quest kind of thing. It makes this huge. And the detail is stunning. In fact, the detail is so much that I don't know that anybody could experience the whole thing at one time. So yeah, imagine going to another planet for a day or so, and that's what Meow Wolf is like. It's hard to say which one I liked better, the one in Santa Fe or the one in Denver. They're very, very different. The one in Santa Fe has a story, and it's like an escape room, except you don't have to escape, but you have to figure things out, or you don't. You can experience these things at any level. You can just go and observe, or you can try to delve into the mysteries. Denver was so much bigger, I found it a little overwhelming. There were so many mysteries, and we only had 90 minutes. There was no way we were going to be able to really delve into any of the mysteries. But that's a good thing, because now I can go back. So, positives. If you're a curious person, if you're interested in art, if you're interested in other worldly experiences, if you like escape rooms, I think you're going to love Meow Wolf in Denver. The cons, and I'm sad to say there are some cons, they only have timed entries. It's so popular that you have to buy a ticket for a time, and those tickets are expensive. It's $50, which I think is quite a lot. I think I only paid $15 to get into Meow Wolf in Santa Fe many years ago, but they've gotten so popular that they can charge $50, and they are doing just fine. So, okay, Another con is parking you have to pay for there. Denver has gotten very urban, and so you have to worry about that too. But other than that, it is a completely unique experience. I think it would be a great winter activity if you want to get out of the cold and spend a day doing something physical. It's quite a large place. You could crawl around. You're not always on 2 feet. Sometimes you have to be on 4 feet. Anyway, I can't, if I'm being very vague about the description, it's because, first off, it's almost impossible to describe. Second off is, I don't want to spoil it for you. But if you like those kind of things, definitely visit Meow Wolf in Denver. I'll have a link in the show notes. It won't be too hard to find. Resource recommendation. So we're all traveling with our kitchens, and, you know, we have limited space for kitchens, so we probably don't have all the same ingredients that we have at home, if we have a home. We have homes. If we have a house, I should say. So what happens if you're making an ingredient, you're like, oh, it needs this thing, and I don't have it? Well, there's a great website for this. It's called allrecipes.com, then, okay, long URL, /articles/common-ingredient-substitutions. I'll have a link in the show notes. But, like, let's say that you're cooking and you need butter, but you're boondocking and you're an hour away from a supermarket. What do you do? Well, maybe you have some vegetable oil, because a cup of butter is about the same as 7/8 of a cup of vegetable oil, like olive oil, say. You might be able to use that. Or if you happen to have shortening, does anyone use shortening anymore? You can just replace that as a 1-to-1 ratio. Or if you have lard, lard is an interesting thing. It's something that, for me, growing up, was like, ew, lard, I don't want that. But it's become more and more common in cooking. Maybe you do have lard. You can use 7/8 of a cup of lard instead of butter. So that's just one example. But let's say you need beer, like you're making a chili, and it says you need beer. Well, you can actually use chicken broth instead of beer. It will do almost the same thing, flavor-wise. But let's talk about some of the more difficult things. Like, what do you do about baking powder? Oh, you need baking powder. I only have baking soda. I don't have baking powder. Well, baking powder is just a mixture of baking soda and cream of tartar. So if you have those two things, you can use 1/4 teaspoon of baking soda and 1/2 teaspoon of cream of tartar, and that will be about 1 teaspoon of baking powder. Don't actually know how that math works. I'm just reading from their website. Or let's say you need ricotta. You can try using silken tofu instead of ricotta. If you chop it up just right, 1-to-1 ratio, it'll work almost the same. Anyway, there's a huge, long list here, and some of the things are pretty clever. Soy sauce, for example. You can mix Worcestershire sauce. Worcestershire sauce? I'm going to go with that. And some water. You just kind of dilute Worcestershire sauce, and that will imitate soy sauce enough to get you through your recipe. Nothing's going to be perfect. It's all going to be a compromise, of course. But heck, it's going to save you from driving 90 minutes to the store. It's worth it. So again, that's at allrecipes.com. I will have a link in the show notes. So folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 214. All these numbers are getting to me because in Team Rubicon, all of our things, all of our reports had numbers, and 214 was a message report. So hey, maybe this is my message to you. This is my 214 anyway. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And until next time, remember the words of Jimmy Dean. I can't change the direction of the wind, but I can adjust my sails to always reach my destination.